case. Mr. Barron, are you on the line with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right, and I believe that Ms. Johnson was already on the line. You're still with us, Ms. Johnson? Ms. Johnson, are you on the line?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. Mr. Barron, we're ready when you are, sir. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I will reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
If it pleases the court, this is a case where the judge applies his rule of thumb definition of contact to find that the appellant had contact with a person who was protected by a protective order. And what he did, as court knows, is just he was on the neighbor's property taking pictures of the car that was in the cars that were in the driveway. And that's where context matters in this case. He was had just been issued a preliminary protective order, and there was a follow-up hearing scheduled in a couple days, and he testified that he was there to take pictures of the car.
This is Judge McCullough. Doesn't contact under our case law include visual contact?
Yes, it does. It certainly could include visual contact.
Yeah, and he's not, I mean, just whatever it was, 30 feet or I forget the exact number, but anyway, fairly close. So why doesn't this fall within the visual contact line of cases, and that's that?
Well, Judge, I would say that, you know, the Elliott case is the sort of controlling case on this issue of contact. And what they say is that at the end of the opinion, they say that the statute permits a protective order that prohibits the respondent from entering a reasonable distance to find space around the petitioner and thus intentionally making visual contact with the petitioner. But what happened in Elliott is the appellant did place himself in visual contact. He was parked a block away. He was openly visible to the protected person. But they found that...
And your client was not trying to hide or anything. He was openly visible. So the question is, did he expect the victim, if we want to call her that, to be there at the time she was there, right?
Well, I would say it's more than that. So I would say that the contact... So what Elliott says is that contact must be intentional, but the visual contact requires more than just an intention being intentionally visible.
Sure.
The way they describe the case, it's acts that intentionally pierce the protective barrier. And what they're talking about, it seems to me, in Elliott, is communicative contact, contact that communicates something. So if he, so the guy in Elliott, the guy in Elliott, Elliott in Elliott, was sitting there in the road gesturing. But there was some question whether those gestures were intended to communicate anything. They say it's insufficient to establish that Elliott intended to visually communicate with Harvey, Harvey being the protected person. And I think that's exactly what we have here. Mr. Wyant didn't do anything to indicate that he intended to visually communicate with the protected person in this case. He had every opportunity.
Why isn't this an issue for the fact finder? In other words, are you trying to intimidate somebody, or are you just on this fact finding or evidence finding errand? And the fact finder says, "Well, we don't buy that. We think he's there to intimidate her, based on all the surrounding circumstances."
Well, I think if the judge, I think, and the judge could, I suppose, have made that ruling, except for I don't think the judge did make that ruling. Instead, he quoted his rule of thumb and sort of relied on that rule of thumb as, here's what I think contact is.
Mr. Barron, this is Judge Pegg. Let me ask you about that rule of thumb assignment of error, I guess, for want of a better term. It seems to me this case, in some respects, turns on what the word contact means in the statute. And that's an issue of statutory construction, which we review de novo. We make the decision of what contact means, not the trial judge. Why should we concern ourselves with his rule of thumb pronouncement from the bench?
That's a good question. Perhaps you shouldn't. The reason why, I suppose, I focus on the judge's rule of thumb comment is because I think it maybe embodies the error that is even reflected, in my opinion, in the Commonwealth's brief, that visual contact by itself is enough. So when the judge says, you know, if you can see him or smell him, you're too close, the visual contact itself does not itself pierce this protective barrier. What if it's
visual contact that is reasonably threatening to the victim?
Oh, I would say that would violate the protective barrier.
Well, then, why? I mean, obviously, this threatened the victim because she reported it, and it's fairly reasonable because he was relatively close at a time when he knew she was home.
Well, I would disagree that she had any testimony that she felt threatened by his contact. Now, why she reported it? We could speculate. I mean, she could. For the advantage that she got by filing the protective order in the first place was to allow her former boyfriend or husband to move back in and get Mr. Wyatt out of the house, which is sort of his theory, which is why he was taking pictures of the car in the driveway, because this guy apparently moved right in. And that's what he wanted, to defend himself against the protective order being entered at that next hearing. So I think one wouldn't say that visual contact alone is never a violation of protective order, but it does require, I think, under Elliott, some kind of intentional communicative contact, some sort of intent to communicate something to the protected person. And so if the court found that him being there taking pictures was an intent to communicate some kind of threat, some kind of intimidation, then I suppose that would satisfy Elliott. He testified without dispute that he was there to take pictures of the cars in the driveway. Made no contact with Ms. Brown, I think her name was, the protected person. Didn't have any gestures, no signs, no, you know, any of the things which people often do when they're trying to make contact. He merely walked to the boundary, took the pictures, walked to another spot on the boundary, took some pictures, and left. And so that's, I think, we would submit that's not intentional visual communication. That's not the kind of contact that the statute prohibits based on the Elliott opinion. So if there aren't any questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Very well. You have 7 minutes remaining.
Thanks.
Ms. Johnson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the Court. This is Victoria Johnson for the Commonwealth. As the appellant just conceded on argument, visual contact that is reasonably threatening, as the appellant conceded, would violate the statute. And that is exactly what the trial court found here. The Supreme Court of Virginia has already defined the term contact in the Elliott case. As the court noted, there's a long line of cases, there is a line of cases holding that visual contact is enough to violate a protective order. In Elliott, the Supreme Court of Virginia talked about, while contact is not defined in the statute, the statute permits the court to fashion protective orders that create a persistent barrier between the petitioner and the respondent so as to reasonably ensure the health and physically safety of the petitioner.
But, I mean, one of the problems that engenders is, how is someone supposed to know where the limitations on that protective barrier are? Now, I know with statutes, we strictly construe them in favor of liberty and against the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
What about these protective orders where someone's going to be sent to prison based on this rather amorphous protective barrier? Now, we would all agree if he's trying to unlock the door, probing at the windows, you know, or whatever, we say, well, or something like that. But here he's doesn't set foot on the property. He's just taking pictures, and then he leaves. So why is that an invasion of that protective barrier?
Well, I have a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. First, The preliminary protective order is in the transcript, or pardon me, in the appendix at 38 and 39. And on appendix 38, the protective order, the preliminary protective order clearly states the respondent shall have no contact of any kind with the petitioner. And that is very broad language, and that would indicate, I submit to a person of common sense, that it means exactly what it says. It means to keep away from the petitioner and have no contact of any kind with her and to just keep away from her and her property and just be away from her. Second, while the defendant had this kind of theory that he was just there and he just stood on the neighbor's land and took some pictures to support himself in the upcoming evidentiary hearing, the trial court clearly rejected that theory as pretextual. Importantly, there were no pictures submitted at that hearing. That's a matter of record. I think it's at Appendix 26, I believe. No, pardon me, Appendix 29. The defendant claimed to be taking pictures for a hearing but did not use any photographs at the hearing. So, you know, the court was able to reject that excuse and was able to make a credibility determination as to the defendant's reason for being there. And we can also look to the other circumstances of the case as to whether he was intimidating the victim and threatening her safety through intimidating her. He was only 50 feet away from her back door, which would indicate that it was not visible to other people near a tree. So it's kind of threatening in and of itself to have someone that you've taken a protective order out on kind of creeping around the back of your house. She also testified, the complainant also testified.
Well, I think a lot of people would be creeped out even if they didn't have a protective order. And
I mean, if I look out and someone's,
you know, on my property line snapping all these pictures, I mean, unless they're wearing a, you know, surveyor's jacket or something, I find that creepy.
I certainly would be as well, and I think that it would cross over from creepy to intimidating, but once it was someone that one had taken a family abuse preliminary protective order out against. And furthermore, the petitioner testified that the defendant was watching her son as he got on the school bus that morning. That's at Appendix 19 and 30. That's intimidating as well, for someone who has subject to a protective order to be watching your child that way. And those were all credibility findings made by the trial court. The trial court was able to look at those circumstances. It rejected the defendant's theory of innocence and accepted the protective order petitioner's, Ms. Brown's, version of events, found that to be truthful. And because of that, the visual contact was sufficient. It was made in an intimidating manner.
It was in the zone of whatever the phrase is of personal protection.
It pierced the barrier between personal protection. And I further submit that the defendant's reliance on the Elliott case is misplaced. In Elliott, the court, you know, set up this definition, but said that in Elliott, the defendant didn't really present a threat because he was in his car a block away, sitting in his car a block away. So at the time, he didn't really present that threat. But here, the defendant was in her, right on the boundary of her backyard. He was, by his own admission, he was standing on the boundary with the neighbor's yard. So he was very close by. While he claimed he didn't know that she was in her house, the trial court, who was the trier of fact and the trier of credibility, obviously did not believe that claim. And, you know, he said that he didn't know for sure that she was in the backyard, or that she was in the house.
Was there any evidence her car was parked in the driveway?
I believe that, well, he certainly saw her out with her son because she saw him that morning, and I believe that her car was parked out in front. There was a whole row of cars parked out front, including hers, and I think her ex-husband's, who she testified stayed over the first couple nights after she got the preliminary protective order because he was concerned, and so she could get some sleep.
Right.
So, this notion that, she kicked out the defendant so she could pursue some other relationship kind of falls hollow on the record as well. So with the definition given in Elliott, as well as the circumstances of the case, I submit that the conviction should be affirmed. As Judge Penny said, the rule of thumb really, that's kind of colorful language from the trial court. I think it's certainly within the spirit of the law. And as Judge Petty said, it's really of no moment here because this court reviews the statutory construction de novo with controlling case law from the Supreme Court of Virginia. And as long as the evidence is sufficient under the controlling statutory construction and under the statute, the conviction should be affirmed.
But if the court was guided by an impermissible ground, wouldn't that be a problem? Even if in the abstract there's sufficient evidence.
No, Your Honor. If using the correct statutory standard, the evidence is sufficient, at the absolute worst, it would be the right result with the wrong reason. And I don't even think the court would need to go that far. If there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer them. But otherwise, I would rest on a Commonwealth's brief and ask that the court affirm.
Very well. Hearing no other questions, Mr. Barron, your remaining time.
Thank you, Judge. I think the Commonwealth brought attention to the protective order, and that's part of the context of the case. So this is a preliminary protective order that is just issued on an ex parte hearing. So the judge has just relied on the affidavit, sworn testimony of the petitioner, and then it's set for this full hearing as the petition sets out on February the 7th, so several days later. And so the idea that the defendant or that the appellant wasn't taking pictures, the court didn't reject that. And the judge specifically says on the appendix, on page 32 of the appendix, that I can't quarrel with Mr. Barron, that he had a right to gather evidence to show whatever might have been helpful to him at the subsequent hearing. But he didn't have the right in the process of doing that to violate the protective order that had already been placed on him. He could have got someone else to do that. It wasn't necessary to go take those photographs. Well, Mr. Wyant isn't represented by counsel at that point in time. I don't know if that's in the record. Yeah, it is in the record, actually. He didn't have an attorney at the time. He's just an average guy. So he's going out trying to get some evidence that he can present at the February 7th hearing.
Well, suppose in order to get those pictures he had to physically go upon her property. Would his motive of taking pictures absolve him of having been in contact with her?
I think not. I think that the protective order on appendix page 39, the box is marked, the respondent shall immediately leave and stay away from the residence, this 115 Thoroughfare Road in Cremora.
So if he had the purest of motives in what he did, if it constitutes a contact, that's not a defense to the charge.
If it constitutes contact, correct. I agree with you. I think that's right. The protective order, the violation of protective order, is a number of grounds that you can violate, and one of them is contact. The others are the things that are laid out in the statute: going and remaining on land, further acts of abuse, committing a criminal offense, and then this fourth one is contacts. It's not numbered in the statute 16.1 to 53.2, but it probably should be numbered. Contacts in violation of the protective order. And so that's why Elliott is so important, because Elliott, the Commonwealth, in my opinion, the Commonwealth misunderstands Elliott, at least understands Elliott differently than I do, and that is that Elliott's not about just about visual contact, but the line in Elliot at the end of it, where they decide Elliot, and they say that he does not establish beyond a reasonable doubt that Elliot intentionally violated the condition of the protective order, because the evidence is insufficient to establish that he intended to visually communicate with Harvey. So the contact, at least the Elliot case of contact, is talking about contact that involves some kind of communication. So there's a whole range of so there's a protective, like the court says, there's this protective barrier, and you pierce it at some point. But what that point is difficult to determine. Clearly, if you walk onto the land, you've pierced it. Clearly, if you called her on the cell phone, like the guy did, like Elliot did in the other case that in that same appeal, he's pierced the protective barrier. But if he walks on the boundary of the property with a good reason, I would submit that he hasn't.
But as Judge McCullough mentioned, isn't it somewhat threatening and offensive to stand there and take pictures of another person, the back door of another person's house?
It certainly could be. It certainly could be seen as offensive or as threatening.
We've,
but
we've gotten to the point where if you go take pictures of a water reservoir, TSA is going to have you in jail in a moment.
Sure, and it could be. And so that's why the appellant's testimony about why he was taking the pictures, and the judge's accepting that explanation in his decision, that he was taking them to gather evidence for trial, is so important. That motive explains why he was taking pictures. He did nothing to intentionally communicate. There was no communicating actions taken. And the mere taking of the photos, the mere presenting himself on the neighbor's property and taking the photos wasn't threatening. The woman never testified that it was threatening, and that's not the standard, because one violates the protective order by calling the protected person and telling them happy birthday or you know, good morning. It's not the threat that violates the protective order. It's the contact. So if there's contact, then he's violated it. But this is, on this boundary, just like Elliot, on this boundary of what this protective barrier is, and I think he's on the safe side of the protective barrier, although very close to the edge. And I'd ask for those reasons that the conviction be reversed.
Very well. Any other questions?
None. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes the docket.